And you are very welcome back to the Monday edition of Northside Today. This is Donny Tarn with you for approximately 29 minutes more. Now, I am delighted to be joined by Roger Cole, chairperson of PANA. And when I saw this interview lined up on the running order, oh boy, was I rubbing my hands. Last week we celebrated 70 years, Roger, of NATO, I think, wasn't it?
Yes, they celebrated 70 years, yeah.
First of all, Roger, welcome to the programme and thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me this afternoon. Before we talk about NATO, I want to chat to you about the 70th. It wasn't really an anniversary. I think it was a commemoration more so than anything of it.
Well, it was 70 years on the go.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. And, you know, it has been absolutely huge because I think anybody, unless they're a total Neanderthal, will say that NATO has probably prevented God knows how many world wars since, even though we have wars going on at all stages in some part of the world. But how much do you think that last week's summit or meeting was overshadowed by the Trump-Macron spat at the beginning and then the Trump-Trudeau spat at the end?
Well, I think it's an indication that Trump is definitely not singing on the same hymn sheet as all the previous US presidents were singing, right? I think he is an extraordinary person to be elected president because normally people who have been previously presidents don't say the kind of things that he says and don't do the kind of things that he does. So there is a sense in which Macron's line was that NATO is brain dead, is a reflection of the serious unease by the partners, especially in Europe, but obviously now clearly Canada as well, who obviously were all active members for many, many years of the NATO. Now, having said that, by the way, you do know that de Gaulle withdrew the military, effectively withdrew from NATO. Now, NATO is a political stroke, military structure, and he withdrew under de Gaulle, they withdrew from the military structure, which was quite significant development. And then under another president whose name escapes me, they rejoined, right? And have been back in again for a while.
But was Canada that, was it Valéry Giscard d'Estaing, I think, that brought him back in, was it?
Well, I'm sorry, I'm showing my age. I can't remember the name of the actual French president. I know who brought them back in. I think it was what's his name now? The guy who helped to invade Libya.
Jacques Chirac.
No, I think so. It doesn't matter. It's really just the principle of the thing that the France under de Gaulle had a certain desire to be not a lapdog of the Americans, right? And you could argue that that's kind of being recreated again. You know what I mean? There's a certain sense of, you know, pride in the French state that, you know, we're not really a lapdog. You know what I mean? Whatever you do, we do is not really that deeply rooted in French culture. Because after all, they did have a sizable empire of their own at one stage. A bit like the British. You know what I mean? They're more into it, but there's definitely different cultures and different divisions. And also the key problem is that the enemy was always going to be the Soviet Union. But the Soviet Union in 1990 collapsed. In other words, that whole rationale for establishing NATO was to defend Western Europe in the event of a invasion of Western Europe by the Soviet Union. And obviously, when the Soviet Union ceased to exist, it certainly wasn't going to be invading anybody on the ground that didn't exist any longer. So that was an opportunity to disband NATO. No, it was no. Its rationale for coming into existence had stopped being there. So far from it, they had, having agreed with Gorbachev that they would allow Germany to be reunited and then brought into NATO, and in exchange for that, Eastern Europe states would be neutral. They wouldn't be involved in any, a bit like what Ireland used to be like, you know, a neutral state that isn't involved in wars. And however, the Americans did the exact opposite. They wanted to sell an awful lot more weapons, and they wanted to win elections where there might be a lot of American Polish people living or whatever. And they expanded eastward and have continued to expand. And now the whole policy now is to become a global organization. I mean, recently Colombia joined NATO. You know what I mean? You're talking about an organization that seeks wars. I mean, for example, it decided under Obama, they said that Venezuela is a national security threat to America. Now, I mean, however big Venezuela is, it's an awful lot smaller than the United States. Hello?
Not wishing to...
You know, I mean, it's not a threat. You know what I mean? It's too small to be a threat. And Libya, that they went to war with, I mean, Libya was not a threat to anybody. And it was invaded. So, I mean, and Afghanistan, they invaded. And it wasn't a threat. I mean, Afghanistan and Libya and Venezuela are three countries that are not a threat. I mean, they're not like the Soviet Union. I mean, I think you can make a legitimate argument that the Soviet Union was a threat to Western Europe. I mean, there's arguments about how valid it was. But nevertheless, you could make a coherent argument that the Soviet Union was an actual threat, even though people would disagree. But you couldn't make the argument that Libya was a threat to NATO, that Venezuela is a threat to NATO, that Afghanistan was a threat to NATO. I mean, they're tiny little countries.
Yeah, it's a strange thing, though, isn't it, in fairness, Roger, that two of the countries you mentioned there, and I'm not sure about the third one, but definitely two of them, has quite large oil reserves. It's a strange... coincidence.
You could argue that's the reason, but the rational argument that was given for these wars in Iraq and in Afghanistan, and that they were threats to stability, you know what I mean, it wasn't true. I mean, you know, they might be dangerous to them, I accept that. You know what I mean, you could say, well, you know, some of these people who were responsible for 9/11, the vast majority of them were actually from Saudi Arabia. And of course, you can't be invading Saudi Arabia because you sell them an awful lot of weapons. You know what I mean? So they went after Afghanistan and they went after Libya and stuff like that. So it's very much a situation where it seeks wars in order to justify its existence.
Yeah, and I suppose
the actual reasons for formation doesn't exist any longer. Like, you know, the Soviet Union doesn't exist. The GDP of Russia is roughly the same as Holland. You know what I mean? It might be geographically a sizable country, but it's not a threat either.
I suppose I should have said at the very start, at the outset of the interview, that Roger, as I said, he's from PAN, and PAN stands for Peace and Neutrality Alliance. And he's obviously the Irish branch of it. Roger, speaking of neutrality, now... I'm not going down the rabbit hole of Shannon and how neutral we are in reality. I'm not going down that rabbit hole at all. But let us, for the purposes of our chat, continue with the theory that Ireland is a neutral country. How does NATO look upon neutral countries?
Well, I think the evidence is that they're seeking to terminate the existence of neutral states and get them all into NATO. I mean, the debate, for example, now Cyprus has been a neutral state for a very, very long time. And there's now growing pressure within Cyprus to become members of NATO. Sweden, that used to describe itself as a neutral state, now collaborates openly and actively with NATO. In militarily wise, right? Finland, not so much, right? And obviously, Sweden is still a neutral country. So there are countries that are, you know, don't want, who that wish to be a small neutral state, that we don't want to get involved in all these endless wars. And then, of course, you have the other issue, which is connected with NATO, but separate to NATO simultaneously, is PESCO, where the government have signed up to. And that's a major, major development, because we have a major housing problem. We have a major health problem in terms of the amount of money that's put into the health system and the amount of money that's put into the both those areas, health and housing, which are big issues for ordinary people. You know what I mean? Like, if it, and what the government has decided to do is to agree to spend a lot more money to help build a European army via PESCO. And that means, inevitably it means, cuts in the amount of money, because they don't have it, because they're spending, buying in, by the way, much more modern weapons that are constructed to go to war. Then they, therefore you have to cut the amount of money you have on health, and you have to cut the amount of money you have on education, and so on and so forth. It goes a long way to explain, for example, why the health system in America is terrible compared to other countries, simply because they have to buy weapons.
But
we're going down the same road.
Roger, can I put this one out to you, sir, because you're far, far more knowledgeable on these items than I am, but if and when PESCO gets up and running, and I use those two words, fully running, I mean, yeah, is that going to diminish NATO? Because, I mean, Europe in itself is a pretty big continent, pretty big landmass. So, I mean, do you need NATO along with PESCO? Is it chipping away at NATO?
Well, that's Macron said that NATO was brain dead, right? So that wasn't a kind of a complimentary thing to say about NATO, if you don't mind me saying so.
I don't think there's any context in which you could take that to be complimentary.
No, I don't think so either, no. Yes, I mean, essentially, Macron and Merkel, the two major political leaders in the European Union, have clearly said it is our objective, and what we want to achieve is the creation of a European state with its own army, with a European army. A little bit like when we were in the British Union, there was one army. And, of course, as you know, there was a lot of support for the British Union at the time. 180,000 people volunteered to die to fight for the British Union because they were so supportive of the British Union. And that's the kind of future they envisage for Irish people. And certainly Radcliffe and Martin, who are the only two parties, by the way, that agree with this. I mean, you know, there's a lot of opposition to it in Ireland. Interesting enough, you know, the first time there was a debate about this whole issue of a European army and the whole issue of neutrality was during the European elections. You know, there was an actual, RTE actually did debate the issue, and they had to, because quite a lot of the candidates, like Claire Daly and Mick Wallace, who got elected, and others, wanted a debate on the issue, and there was one. Now, we had previously commissioned Red Sea poll to ask people were they in favour of neutrality or not, and the figure usually was around about 58% of people were in favour, a clear majority, 58% of people were in favour of Irish neutrality. You know, and then at the end of that European election campaign, RTE again hired our Red Sea poll, which is an independent organisation, to ask people, and that figure went up, and I can quote you, it was 82% of the Irish people wanted neutrality, and I quote, in all its aspects. So, like, when you're talking to me, you're talking to somebody who reflects the views of 82% of the Irish people.
Yeah, the other side of it, of course, Roger, is, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but is neutrality not enshrined in our constitution? So the only way that we can revoke neutrality is by a referendum?
It's not in our constitution. The Irish neutrality was only ever policy. The first person to advocate neutrality was Theobald Wolfe Tone way back in 1790. So it's a deeply rooted tradition. when the Irish Republic state was negotiating with the British Union, after the truce between the Irish Republic and government and the British imperial state, there was a series of negotiations. People would present their papers. Okay, it ended up, as we know, with the treaty. But in the process of negotiations, the Irish Republican government would put together paper documents with what we'd like to see. And what they said to the British state, we will agree to absolutely make certain that this state, this new state that's coming into existence, would not be used ever, and we will never allow it to be used as a base to attack Britain. And in exchange, Irish neutrality would become permanent. That never happened. And so, but obviously the commitment to neutrality was extremely strong, because it's very, as I said, it's very deeply rooted in our history. But it only became, it was only policy. You know what I mean? So that when we stayed neutral in the Second World War, Eamon de Valera quoted what was called the Hague Convention of 1907, which defines in international law what a neutral state is. And he said, he didn't quote the Constitution, because it wasn't in the Constitution. He just quoted international law of the Hague Convention of 1907, which defines the duties and responsibilities of a neutral state, and said, under that convention, as a state, we have every right to be neutral and we're going to stay neutral. And they did. If we had gotten involved in the war, we had no, the whole Dublin would have been just blown to bits. You know what I mean? We didn't have the infrastructure to defend ourselves in any way whatsoever. So it was not in the Constitution. It's only ever been policy. And what's been happening is that successive governments have changed that policy. And as you said, you don't want to go into detail about Shannon, but that's the obvious example.
Yeah, well, that's what I was coming at, Roger, because it is an obvious example of where you could say, well, this definitely steps over the line of neutrality, because you are aiding a foreign power in their quest. Your gut instinct, Roger, what does it tell you? Is NATO going to become more and more irrelevant as time progresses?
I actually think it all depends on who wins the next presidential election in the United States of America. If, for example, somebody from the Democratic Party wins it, you're probably going to have a reversion back to the same policies they had before Trump. Right? See, I don't think anybody knows what Trump is going to do tomorrow. I think there's a lot of evidence that
I would contend that Trump doesn't know what Trump is going to do tomorrow.
You beat me to it. I was just going to say exactly the same thing. So you're not dealing with what you'd call a normal president that makes relatively, however bad they are, relatively rational decisions. You're talking about somebody that nobody knows, including himself, what he's going to say next in the next hour, let alone the next day. So it's difficult to be a member of a nuclear-armed military alliance with the major power in that alliance led by somebody, and you have no idea what they're going to do next. That's what I think Macron meant when he said it's brain dead. In other words, he said that Trump is brain dead. It was specifically aimed at Trump. I mean, he just thinks, obviously Macron thinks that and obviously it's also clear that a lot of people in Europe and Canada, no, it's virtually everybody else, agrees with him.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, though, because, I mean, Macron has enough on his plate domestically, as we see at the moment, and ongoing issues in France. Trudeau barely squeaked home in the last elections in Canada. Trump, as you say, is a total wild card, capable of doing anything. And the only thing that he seems to be able to do, or seems to have been able to do, is to get commitments to up payments into NATO of the 2% of GDP. Now, if countries follow through with that promise, you know, money makes the world go round and money makes organisations function. So if the money starts pouring into NATO, here we go again.
Well, yes, but I mean, in order to, I mean, when the Soviet Union collapsed, most politicians all over Europe said we need to stop spending that kind of money on defence when it's absolutely clear we're not actually going to be invaded. You know what I mean? Like, if you were, if say, for example, you're in a housing pressure group and you want the government to spend more money on housing, and the government says, well, no, we can't spend any more money on housing because we have to buy these weapons instead because the Soviet Union is going to invade us. And they didn't. They bought the weapons and they got less housing. Now, I mean, what has been happening is that once you decide to spend more money on weapons, then you have less money to spend on your health system, you have less money to spend on your housing system, you have less money to spend on your educational system. So all these governments are deciding to do this, to cut back on health, on housing and education, and buy more weapons. And I mean, I'm sure it's completely untrue that the weapons industry give money to politicians. I'm sure there's no truth in that whatsoever. But nevertheless, this is the consequences of going down that road of spending money. Now, the question is, who are the threats? I mean, does anybody really think that the Soviet Union will be reborn tomorrow? Or if you're going to spend the money, well, maybe you should wait to see that if it's reborn or not. I mean, you know what I mean? There's no evidence that. I mean, I don't think there's a shred of evidence that the Soviet Union is going to come back. So I don't understand the rationale, how they keep on getting away with this desire to spend more and more money, and why there isn't people in the European Union and in this country, because that's what they're doing with PESCO. They're going to be spending 2% of the GDP in Ireland on buying massive weapons. At the moment now, for example, it's got very, very little coverage. For example, I'll give you an example. Most people, when they think of the Irish Navy, they think the function of the Irish Navy is to defend our fisheries, our waters, where we catch our fish, to make certain that there aren't people coming in and nicking our fish or bringing in drugs into our country. And that's the central role of defence and valid defence, which PANA would completely support, for having an Irish Navy and making certain that it's fit for purpose. But, in fact, the Irish government are now spending a massive amount of money buying a ship that's specifically designed to carry large numbers of troops to take part largely in an invasion of somebody else's country.
Yeah, well, I'd ask the question there, Roger, where are they going to get them from? Because my understanding is that 3/4 of our naval fleet are in dry dock because they don't have the crews to keep them on the seas. Roger.
You see, you're right there, you see, but that's the problem, isn't it? That instead of paying the soldiers, our sailors and Air Force people with a functioning army that was there for those purposes, they're spending a huge amount of money, massive amount of money, on buying ships to invade other people's countries. And they're just losing the run of themselves, and it needs to be debated.
Roger, I could talk to you all day about this because I find it absolutely fascinating. Roger Cole, chairman of PANA, chair, we have to be politically correct in these times, of PANA, the Peace and Neutrality Alliance in Ireland. Roger, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon.
Just one little thing before you go.
Yes,
anybody
indeed.
Can look, our website is pana.ie.
And that is, as we said originally, the Peace and Neutrality Alliance. And you know what? Peace and neutrality is not a bad thing at all, because a bit more of it maybe, and we might be living in a far, far better world. Roger, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you indeed.
Bye-bye now.